This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of webyeshiva.org with an introductory shiur on the thought of Maimonides, the Rambam, and his introduction to Perek Chelek. Okay, good evening. Welcome. This is the first of our weekly series on the thought of the Rambam, and I think the course is entitled His Introduction to Olam Haba. His introduction to Olam Haba. I recall a mentor, friend, teacher of mine, somebody that played various roles at different points in my life. When I was in high school, very anxious about what used to be called the SATs in America, those all-important exams to get into university, this person encouraged me to also consider the OHEEs. The Olam Haba entrance exam, which is the test that we take every day of our life. The Rambam had a lot to say about Olam Haba, about Olam Hazeh, the world to come, as well as this world. What happens to us after we die, eschatology, what will happen at the end of days, Mashiach, etc. Some of the things that he said were rather controversial. Some of the things that he said, he was criticized and attacked for. We'll talk all about that. But before we get into the main learning of the text that we'll be studying, which is his introduction to Perek Chelek, a chapter in Masechet Sanhedrin, which gives him a springboard to discuss Olam Haba. I'll get to that in a few minutes. I'm just going to give a somewhat, hopefully brief, introduction in general to the Rambam. This may be review for some, and this may be new for some. So if this is new for you, I hope that you'll find it enlightening. If it's a review, well, it's always good to review. I think it's important to do this. I think it's important to do this because understanding who the Rambam was and the genre in which he was working and writing and trying to connect the dots amongst the different parts of his life and his work serves as it'll give us a useful palette on which, or useful canvas rather, on which to paint as we start delving into the real work of dealing with the ideas. So I'm going to start that. Before I go any further, I'm just going to put in the chat box my email address, my Google name, and my Skype name as well is just Jeffrey Sachs. You're welcome to contact me about anything related to our shiur or related to anything else as well in between. We only do meet once a week throughout the course of the semester. But please feel free to be in touch with me as we go along. I would also just really encourage everyone to invest a couple of dollars in getting a webcam and a microphone. It really greatly enhances the experience for you. It greatly enhances the experience for me. It creates the atmosphere of the real type of interactive learning that we're aiming for, and not merely, you know, being passively along for the ride. If you're interested in that, there are many, many wonderful websites that you can download shiurim and listen to them on your iPod. What we're doing here is different. It's meant to be interactive. It's meant to be dialogical, you know, beyond the chats, beyond the chats, you know, to actually speak. I am going to now resend to everybody my email address and my Google name, Skype name, which is the same. There you go. There you have it. The Rambam. Here we see him. I'm pretty sure that this iconic picture of the Rambam is not actually the Rambam. I'm sure somebody has done a doctoral dissertation trying to discover which Sultan this actually is a picture of, but it in fact, is the iconic picture of the Rambam. I don't think we actually have any idea what the Rambam really looked like, although this picture, this famous picture or version of it, actually at one point appeared on the one Israeli shekel note. Nowadays it's all coins, but once upon a time when the shekel was worth more, the Rambam's picture appeared on the shekel note, like George Washington in America. You can still find these old paper shkalim, these paper monetary notes with the iconic picture of the Rambam on it. The Rambam, of course, and again, just by way of review, in case there's somebody from this is new, Rambam is an acronym for Rebbe Moshe Ben Maimon, in English, of course, known as Maimonides. The Rambam lived from 1135, they used to say until 1205, but probably it was really 1204. He died at the end of December of 1204, but since the way the Hebrew dates work, it was already the Hebrew date of the following year, the date that corresponds largely to 1205. I think very often you'll see his dates as 1135 to 1205, or as a student of mine when I taught high school in America famously once said, only a half an hour? Yeah, only a half an hour. The Rambam, Maimonides, is of course the towering figure of halakha, of Jewish thought, within the period of the Rishonim, the period which stretches, you know, roughly speaking, from around the year 1000 until the middle of the 16th century, he stands like a colossus, head and shoulders above the rest, both in his period and in all subsequent periods. It's not for nothing that it may have been Rabbeinu Yonah, perhaps it was somebody else, who coined the famous aphorism, Mimoshe v'ad Moshe lo kam kimoshe. From Moshe Rabbeinu until Moshe ben Maimon, there was none that can compare to the Rambam. And the Rambam is one of those great historic figures that everybody wants the Rambam on their team. Everybody wants to be able to point to the Rambam, and it's almost impossible to think or to write or to be involved in Torah discussions, both in Jewish thought, in Jewish philosophy, and certainly in Jewish law, in halakha, without encountering the Rambam, without contending with the Rambam. He's just head and shoulders above everyone else. Not to in any way disparage, God forbid, the other great scholars and rabbis and chachamim of our heritage, but the Rambam stands apart. He was born again in 1135 in Spain, in Cordoba, Spain. If anybody's ever traveled to Spain, they apparently like have a sense of where his home was, or at least they say that they do, and there's a statue of him there. If you Google these things, you can find it easily. In 1148, probably around the time of his bar mitzvah, the Almohads, who were a group of, well, I guess we consider them fanatic Islamic invaders, that invade southern Spain. It's part of the battle that goes on throughout the Iberian Peninsula up until 1492. 1492 being that very important date, not just the date that Columbus sails the ocean blue, but the date in which Isabella and Ferdinand, who financed Columbus's trip, succeed in the Reconquista, in reconquering the Iberian Peninsula. The line of scrimmage between Christian Spain in the north and Muslim Spain in the south goes up and down throughout the early medieval period. It's only in 1492 that Ferdinand and Isabella essentially succeed in reconquering Spain for the Christian side, but Muslim Spain, the Muslim culture, ruled much of Spain, certainly in the Rambam's time, because they succeed in reconquering Spain and kicking out the infidel Muslims, they decide, perhaps influenced by some fanatic clergyman, that they also have to clean house at home, and they also kick out the Jews, who, at least the Jews who refuse to convert to Christianity. And of course, 1492, for us, maybe the most significant event of that year, but the third major event involving the court of Ferdinand and Isabella, is the Gerush Sfarad, the expulsion of the Jews of Spain, probably around the week of Tisha B'Av, in 1492. So these three things happen later in the history of Spain, but we're talking about the 12th century. Around 1148, around the time of his bar mitzvah, the Almohads invade, and the family of the Rambam flee. They flee to we don't know where. Apparently, they cross the Strait of Gibraltar, and they get into northern Africa. They spend some time in Fez, in Morocco, or in what today is Morocco. I'm not sure if it was called Morocco then. And they travel around. We don't know. There's a chapter in the Rambam's biography during his teenage years and his early adolescence where we don't know a lot. At a certain point, they end up in Eretz Yisrael. But at that time, in the early 12th century in Israel, life was very difficult, and they apparently don't stay. By the time he's 30, in 1165, he has written a commentary on the Mishnah. The Mishnah, the great work of rabbinic Judaism, the Mishnah is composed or compiled around the year 200. Believe it or not, there's no commentary written on the Mishnah. The Gemara, what we know as the Gemara, what collectively the Mishnah and the Gemara together, known as the Talmud, the Gemara is not technically a commentary on the Mishnah. Those of you that have spent some time learning Gemara know, obviously, that the Gemara is a kind of freewheeling conversation around the Mishnah. But it's not a commentary on the Mishnah the way that Rashi is a commentary on Chumash. And the Rambam writes a comprehensive commentary on the Mishnah, and he's the first to do that, which is pretty remarkable because the Mishnah had been around for almost 1,000 years. And the Rambam writes this comprehensive commentary on the Mishnah. He finishes it by the time he's 30 years old, which is pretty remarkable. We have some people online with us that are over 30. And we have some people online with us who are much younger than 30. To have learned the entire Mishnah by the time you're 30 is a good accomplishment. To have written a comprehensive commentary on it is something else altogether. He writes the commentary on the Mishnah in Arabic, or in Judeo-Arabic, because that was the lingua franca of his time. And it's translated into Hebrew. Everything the Rambam wrote, with one important exception, was written in Arabic, which again was the way that many great Torah scholars in America today write in English. Arabic was a very natural choice because that was the language of the audience to whom he was speaking, but it was translated, in most cases, things that he wrote were translated in his lifetime. He had one particular fellow named Shmuel ibn Tibon. There were others, of course. There's Al-Kharizi and other Jewish figures who translate into Hebrew, but it's written in Arabic, and it's translated into Hebrew. We'll be studying it in a Hebrew translation. I'll talk about the different editions a little later. That's the commentary on the Mishnah. I'm going to put an asterisk in the conversation at this point and come back to it in a few minutes, because what we'll be studying is an essay that appears in that commentary to the Mishnah, which again was one of the Rambam's earliest works. Around 1168, in his early 30s, he ends up in Cairo. He ends up in the Jewish suburb of Cairo. If anybody's ever been to Cairo, I was in Cairo many years ago, over 20 years ago, when I was a student in Rabbi Brachminter's yeshiva, before Pesach, a number of us went down to Cairo on a type of vacation for a couple of days. I don't know if students still do that. I doubt it. But there are things to be seen. There's a synagogue that houses the very famous Cairo Geniza. If you don't know what the Cairo Geniza is, you should Google it and find out. Geniza. The Cairo Geniza. And the Rambam becomes the leader of the Jewish community in Egypt, which then was a fairly friendly society to Jewish life and to Jewish observance at that period. The Rambam becomes the leader of the Jewish society. He's a dayan, he's a judge of the people. He's the rabbi, the title was Nagid, type of the head of the Jewish community. He was also, of course, a physician. He was a court physician. There's a fascinating letter in which he writes to one of his students describing what his day is like. It's just mind-boggling to imagine what it was like. If I can find it in English, I'll post it up to the website. It's really just amazing to read. And he also, of course, undertook his own scholarship and his scholarship and writing and halachic writing and philosophical writing. Chaim asks a question. Spain had come under Muslim control. What about Cairo? Yes, Cairo was also under Muslim control, but it was a more tolerant Muslim society, less oppressive. In Spain, they were having forced conversions. Muslim society, it's important. I mean, we'll be talking a little bit about Muslim society as we go along, because the Rambam spent his whole life there. There's Muslim society, and there's Muslim society, and not all Islamic countries and not all Islamic cultures are the same. There were periods of tremendous oppression, of forced conversions, conversion or the sword. And there were periods and locales where Muslim society was extraordinarily welcoming to Jewish life. And on the contrary, many of the great Rishonim, many of our great scholars from the medieval period, lived and worked and flourished under Islamic rule, places where Judaism was recognized as a legitimate minority religion and was protected as such. So there were different types of Islamic culture. Spain was a more difficult place, and Cairo and Egypt was a more tolerant place, at least in the period that we're talking about. Saul asks a question about the Sefer HaMitzvot. I'm about to address that. While he's in Spain, around 1170, between 1170 and 1180, he authors the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah is his magnum opus. Here you go. I keep a copy close at hand. This is a small desk size. I have the large size. I have a few different editions. You should have a Mishnah Torah in your house. It's the kind of book that a Jew should have close at hand. It's a basic of the Jewish library. The Rambam's Mishnah Torah is a reference, of course, to Sefer Devarim, to the book of Deuteronomy. Sefer Devarim is called the Mishnah Torah because after the first four books of the Chumash, Mishnah Torah, Moshe's big recounting of the Torah, that's what Mishnah Torah means, literally. The Mishnah from Sheni, the second teaching, Deuteronomy, right, means the second telling of the law, as it were, from Du to. So the Rambam calls his book the Mishnah Torah, because he claims it is a retelling of the entire. I see that there's a few sound problems. Ezra, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Some people are reporting some sound problems. Maybe you can look in the chat and take care of that. The Rambam calls it the Mishnah Torah because it's the retelling, it's the recapping of the entire oral law. As a matter of fact, in the introduction, he says that if you have the Bible, the written law, and the Mishnah Torah, you'll have it all. Because what had happened, around the year 200, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi writes the Mishnah. Around the year 500 or so, the Talmud is, at least the Talmud Bavli, is completed. And then a body of commentary and codification and exposition start growing around all of this, around the kernel, the core of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law. And it gets a little unwieldy over the course of 1,000 years or so. The Rambam writes this encyclopedia of halakha, called the Mishnah Torah. You know that the Gemara is very associative, even though each volume of the Gemara, each Masechta of the Talmud, is loosely organized around one topic, but the Gemara is very associative, so you can find any one topic addressed in multiple places, and it's not always easy to find exactly what you're looking for. I mean, now we have all types of indexes, and we have databases and everything else, but the material itself is rather unwieldy, and the Rambam, with great organizational power, produces this encyclopedia of halakha, which is a masterpiece. By way of introduction, he writes something called the Sefer HaMitzvot. The Sefer HaMitzvot is a count of the 613 mitzvot. You know, you're all aware that there's 613 mitzvot. The Gemara, the very end of Masechet Makot, says, here you have it, Dorash Rabbi Simloi, Sheish Me'ot U'Shlosh Esrei Mitzvot, Ne'emru Lo L'Moshe. 613 mitzvot were told to Moshe. There are 613 biblical commandments. Shlosh Me'ot V'Shishim V'Chamesh Lavin, 365 negative commandments, prohibitions, lavin, lav from the language lo, you can't do them. Keminyan yimot hachama, 365 prohibitions, like 365 days of the solar year. Matayim v'arbaim v'shmonam asei, 248 positive commandments, keneged evarav shel adam. Chazal had a certain count by which the human body had 248 components to it, parts to it. I guess it depends on how you count. But 248 positive commandments opposite these 248 parts of the body. Right? So in other words, let's do the math. 365 plus 248 equals 613, right? Pretty simple. Omar Rav Hamnuna. Rav Hamnuna said, Maikra, what is the Pasuk? Torah tziva lanu Moshe, Morasha. Torah, the gematria. The gematria of Torah is how much? 'Rafi, you're doing the math. What's the gematria of the word Torah? Where do you get 613? You get 613 because Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Moshe taught us Torah, 611 mitzvot. And the first two mitzvot, Saul points out, are the first two dibrot that Hashem himself taught at Har Sinai. So 611 plus 2. Now obviously this whole thing is in Agadata. Obviously this whole thing is, this is not the source of the idea. But the point is there's this long-standing tradition which long predates Rav Sinloy, that there's 613 mitzvot, and not just 613 mitzvot, 365 positive mitzvot, 365 negative mitzvot, 248 positive mitzvot. The interesting thing, of course, is that what would you expect to find next in the Gemara? A list of the 613 things. But what happens? Sof pasuk, that's the end. That's the end of the Gemara. The Gemara itself, interestingly, does not list what the 613 mitzvot are. I mean, there's certain things, the majority of things, there's consensus. Everybody understands, everybody admits that Shabbat is a mitzvah, Tefillin is a mitzvah, Lulav is a mitzvah, Shofar is a mitzvah, Matzah is a mitzvah. Everybody also agrees you can't kill, you can't steal, etc., etc., etc. But there is no one comprehensive list, believe it or not, of what the 613 mitzvot are. From Rav Sadia Gaon and on, certain chachamim start making lists. But when you make a list, you're limited. You have to, your list has to conform to this outline. 365 negative mitzvot, 248 positive mitzvot, equaling 613. The Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvot makes a list. Not only does he do that, in the introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvot, he gives the rules, the principles, he calls them shorashim, the roots, that explain how he came up with his list. The exegetical principles which he followed in order to create his list. However, although there's consensus about the overwhelming majority of these 613, not everyone agreed with the Rambam. The Ramban, Nachmanides, for example, disagreed with certain things. So, for example, well, this is just an important side point. Are you aware, is anybody aware of any other minyan ha-mitzvot, any other listing of the mitzvot? Chafetz Chaim, the Sefer HaChinuch. Right, so the Sefer HaChinuch, the Chafetz Chaim made a list of the mitzvot that are applicable b'zman hazeh, nowadays. The Rambam's list of 613 mitzvot include many mitzvot which unfortunately are not applicable today because the Beit HaMikdash doesn't exist and many of the halachot, many of the mitzvot are connected to the service in the Beit HaMikdash. But a few people mention here the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch is a wonderful book. It's printed in some of the Chumashim. It's printed, it's available in English. It's available in Hebrew. It's a wonderful book with a little essay on each of the 613 mitzvot, which I'm pretty sure essentially follows the count of the Rambam. He just elaborates on each of the mitzvot, and he gives you some of the background and some of the halachot. How does the Sefer HaChinuch organize its list? How does he present the list? Eliyahu lists a few others, counts them the mitzvot, the Bahag, the Smag, etc. How does the Sefer HaChinuch present the list? What order does he present the mitzvot? Right, according to the Parshiot, in the order that they appear in the Chumash. The Rambam doesn't do this. The Rambam lists the mitzvot in a type of hierarchy. First the mitzvot aseh, and then the mitzvot lo taseh, first the positive and then the negative. The mitzvot aseh, he starts from more general, more universal principles, and then goes to more specifics. So the first mitzvah that the Rambam lists is belief in God, because that, for the Rambam, is the Yesod HaYesodot V'Amud HaChachamot. That's how he starts the Mishnah Torah. The foundation stone of everything is belief in God. And then he moves on from there. The Ramban, for example, Nachmanides, disagrees with the Rambam. And he says, believe it or not, belief in God is not one of the 613 mitzvot. Be clear. For the Ramban, for Nachmanides, you have to believe in God. But, he says, that's a precursor. It's an obligatory precursor to a discussion of mitzvot. But it, in and of itself, does not get counted as one of the Taryag mitzvot. So if the Ramban removes one of the Taryag mitzvot, what does he have to do? He has to compensate, and he has to add another mitzvah to take its place, because the math, at the end of the day, the math all has to work out. And if he takes something off the list of 365, or rather the 248, if he takes one of the positive mitzvot out, he has to substitute a different positive mitzvah. Does anybody know another very famous machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban in terms of the Minyan HaMitzvot? The most famous being, perhaps, this question of... Yafet. This question of belief in God. So what does the Rambam do? Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban says there's a mitzvah to conquer and dwell in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel. Interestingly, the Rambam does not count that as one of the mitzvot. Now this is interesting because we know that the Rambam said many times how important it is to live in Eretz Yisrael. And many people over the centuries have tried to figure out how it could be that he doesn't count it as one of the mitzvot. And there are many, many different answers that are given to this question. Because it could be there are certain things that are obligatory, but yet don't get counted on technical grounds. This is all by way of introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvot. The Sefer HaMitzvot is a sort of preamble to the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah, these 14 volumes, the Mishnah Torah is sometimes also called the Yad HaChazaka. The Yad HaChazaka, the strong hand, Yud Dalid, being, of course, the gematria for 14, because there are 14 books in the Mishnah Torah. Each book subdivided into different sections of specific halachot, each section subdivided into chapters, etc. The Mishnah Torah itself is written in Hebrew, in a type of imitation of Mishnaic Hebrew. A type of imitation of Mishnaic Hebrew. It's the only thing the Rambam writes in Hebrew, because he understood that this book was somehow in a different category. That this book is somehow in a different category. Chaim asks a question about, does the Rambam include the 13 principles of faith in the Minyan HaMitzvot? That is the topic of what we'll be discussing throughout the course. I'll come back to that later. That's the Mishnah Torah. Now, interestingly, as opposed to almost anybody else that deals with that deals with halachic writing, the very first of the 14 books of the Mishneh Torah, of this great halachic work, appears to us to be a work of philosophy. It's called Sefer Mada. Oops, let me change to a color that you can see. It's called Sefer Mada. The book of Mada, we generally use Mada to mean science, but the book of wisdom. And it deals with various philosophical issues, which we'll introduce as we move along. Because the Rambam dealt with philosophical issues in what otherwise is a halachic work, this raised some concern amongst people that were not quite as philosophically oriented. And this was another reason that the Rambam sometimes got himself into hot water. And we'll address this as we go along as well. The Sefer Mada is in many ways an expansion and a distillation of the ideas that he wrote in parts of the earlier commentary on the Mishnah, and as we move along, we'll be looking at those parallel passages. Around 1190, closer towards the end of his life, 14, 15 years before he dies, he authors his third major important work, the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed. It's written ostensibly as a response to a student. He has a student named Yosef ben Yehuda. I'm always very sensitive to poor Yosef ben Yehuda, because my own name is Yosef ben Yehuda. Yosef ben Yehuda was a Navoch. He was perplexed. That's something that most of us can relate to, having been perplexed ourselves. And Yosef ben Yehuda had a number of questions about things in the realm of philosophy and how to understand the Torah, etc. And the Rambam wrote this book as a response to some of his questions, the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. And it deals with an array of issues. It's to a certain degree an attempt to correlate and synthesize classic Greek philosophy, Aristotelian philosophy, with the Torah worldview. And again, this was something of an innovation, and something which not everybody, not all of his contemporaries and those that followed in the generations and centuries afterwards, not everybody appreciated. But the Moreh Nevuchim is a pillar, a classic of Jewish philosophy, and we will also be looking at some of the parallel passages there. Let me just make a few other comments in passing. Where are we? Let me just turn the page. There are a number of important works. First of all, if you go on our website, just you should be aware of this in general, on our website at this URL, webyeshiva.org/sfarim, S-E-F-A-R-I-M, you will find a roundup of links to online books. Most of the classic Jewish bookshelf is available online on different websites. Wikipedia, the Hebrew Wikipedia, has a lot of stuff, and many other places have a lot of stuff online in Hebrew. So classic Jewish books, that if it happens that you don't own one, I mentioned that it's important that everybody should have a Mishneh Torah in their house. If you don't happen to have a Mishneh Torah in your house, it's all available for free online anyway, at least in Hebrew. At that link for webyeshiva.org/sfarim, you'll find a link to various websites that have the Mishneh Torah online, including one that has all of Sefer Mada online with Nikud, with vowels in Hebrew, which is a very useful thing to have. You'll also find links to the Guide for the Perplexed online in Hebrew as well as in English, although not the best English translation. If somebody's interested in buying some books, the Guide to the Perplexed, this edition, which is available on Amazon in two volumes, translated by Shlomo Pines, P-I-N-E-S, in two volumes, this is the best edition in English available. And I mean, I happen to notice it's available on Amazon.com. This book, anthologized by the late Isidore Twersky, Rabbi Yitzchak Twersky, a Maimonides reader, is an anthology of, you know, kind of like a reader's digest of all of the Rambam's writings in English. It's highlights of, you know, like the great passages from the Mishneh Torah, from the Mor Nebuchim, from some of his other writings on science and medicine, some of his famous letters, as well as the text that we're going to be studying, the main text we'll be studying, available in English. We're going to be studying in Hebrew for ideological reasons, but it's available in translation. The translation is okay. Rabbi Twersky didn't do the translations. He anthologized from pre-existing translations into this one book called A Maimonides Reader. You might see it with a different cover. It has a couple of different printings of it, all offsets of the same book with different covers, but they're all the same thing. It doesn't matter. So this is Maimonides Reader, edited by Rabbi Isidore Twersky. These are two things that if you're interested in adding to your library of Jewish books related to the Rambam, these are two things that are, of course, worth getting. Again, as well as a copy of the Mishneh Torah. There are a few different editions of the Mishneh Torah. There's the classic, you know, this is the classic edition, which looks something like, you know, like a classic Hebrew book. And these you can get a small desk copy for not a lot of money. There are modern editions. There's an excellent, excellent edition edited by Shabsi Frankel that tends to be a little more pricey and takes up a lot more bookshelf space. And there's a very good edition of the Mishneh Torah put out by Mossad Harav Kook, which is called the Rambam Le'am, the Rambam for the Masses, which is just the text of the Rambam with a few explanatory notes, but the text of the Rambam is printed with, the text of the Mishneh Torah is printed with Nikud, with vowels and punctuation, you know, which is always a good thing. Now let's get into our topic. Again, apologies to anybody for whom this was review. Basic introduction to the life of the Rambam. In the commentary to the Mishnah, which goes Mishnah by Mishnah, and he makes points on the different Mishnayot, makes halachic points, tries to tell you what the halacha is, tries to explain things that come up in the Mishnah. In a few places in the commentary on the Mishnah, he has these excurses, these digressionary, these digressionary discussions, almost standalone essays, each of which is worth reading. The introduction to the entire work, the introduction to the commentary on the Mishnah is itself a tour de force, a comment, a history of Torah Shebaal Peh, the history and the mechanics of how the oral law works. In Sanhedrin, in Masechet Sanhedrin, there's a Mishnah. In a Perek, the Perek is colloquially called Chelek. This Mishnah says the following. The Mishnah says, Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek le'olam haba. All of Israel, all of the Jewish people have a share in the world to come. the Mishnah does not tell us what the world to come is. It takes it for granted that we know what it is. I mean, it's obvious that the world to come is a good thing. We'd like to get there. But the Mishnah doesn't explain, you know, what it is precisely. So all of Israel have a share in the world to come. Shine'emar, as it says, the Pasuk in Yeshayahu, V'ameich kulam tzadikim. Your people, God, they are all righteous. Le'olam yirshu aretz. They will always, in all cases, for eternity, inherit the land. What's the land? The land is not Eretz Yisrael. The land is the world to come. Then, in typical Mishnaic fashion, after telling you a principle, the principle is all of the Jewish people have a share in the world to come. However, there are exceptions to the rule. V'elu she'en lehem chelek le'olam haba. And these, this list, are the people that don't have a share in the world to come. For example, somebody that says, Ein tchiyat hametim min haTorah. Somebody that denies the revival of the dead. One of our core principles of belief, that when the Messiah will come, when Mashiach will come, the dead will be revived. We say it every day in the Amidah, Mechayei hametim. Somebody that denies this principle does not have a share in the world to come. Somebody that says, Ein Torah min haShemayim. Somebody that says that the Torah is not from heaven, that God did not give the Torah, has no share in the world to come. And a few other examples of people who lose their share in the world to come. But in principle, minus these people, everybody has a share in the world to come. The Rambam uses this first Mishnah in Chelek. The Perek is called Chelek, right? A share. The Rambam uses this first Mishnah in Chelek as a springboard for a stand-alone discussion of what is Olam Haba? What is the Jewish belief in what happens to us after death? Who gets there? What is required of somebody in order to gain that reward? And he lists 13, his famous 13 principles of faith. The home address for the 13 principles of faith is here in this essay at the beginning of the commentary on this Mishnah. These 13 principles of faith, we know them as the Ani Mamins. I mean, we know them most famously because some of them were set to music, right? Those great Jewish music. Anybody that's ever been to a Kumsitz in their life knows Ani Mamin Bemuna Shelema Beviyat HaMashiach Ani Mamin, etc. I'll spare you the rest of my singing. We know those Ani. The Rambam didn't write the Ani Mamins. Somebody else summarized the 13 principles into these 13 sentences, each beginning Ani Mamin. Well, we all know Yigdal, that piyut that's recited very often at the end of davening, Yigdal Elokim Chai, right, which is a poetic rendering of the 13 principles of faith. Again, the Rambam didn't write Yigdal. Somebody else distilled the 13 principles into that poem. But the Rambam enumerates the 13 principles of faith as the requirements of belief without which a person loses their share in the world to come. Now, to be clear, there were other Rishonim, other Chachomim, that disagreed with the Rambam and thought that there aren't 13 principles of faith. Maybe there are only 3 principles of faith. Maybe there are fewer than 13. Maybe there are certain things that you have to believe in, that the Torah requires you to believe in, but somebody who makes a mistake and doesn't believe that is making an error, but an error for which you do not lose your share in the world to come. And these are the different areas of machlokas that others had with the Rambam. But the Rambam enumerates 13 principles of faith. The absence of any one would, you'd lose your, you'd fail the O-H-E-E. You'd fail the Olam Haba entrance exam. And this essay, which we're going to now get into, is the Rambam's enumeration of that. Since we're talking about Olam Haba, the Rambam, before he enumerates the 13 principles of faith, he does a few different things. One is he tries to explain to you his conception of Olam Haba. Then he tries to explain to you, in general about Schar v'Onesh, reward and punishment, and how our view of what happens to us at the end of time fits in with our overall conception of reward and punishment. While doing that, he feels it's necessary to describe the proper motivation for doing mitzvot. Even though we believe in reward and punishment, we don't believe that we should be motivated by reward and punishment. And he gets into a discussion of doing mitzvot lishma, doing mitzvot with the proper motivation. We'll discuss that when we get to that. Since the sources for all of our beliefs on this matter are in the realm of the Agadah, the non-legal, we generally divide rabbinic literature into halakha, a discussion maybe of the consequences of lighting a fire on Shabbat, a discussion of the proper way of putting on tefillin or constructing a sukkah, a discussion of financial law, of how witnesses work, how the court is structured, and Agadah. Agadah are the non-legal sections of the Talmud, of the Midrash, of the rabbinic literature, that describe matters of belief, matters of principle, matters of values, that describe, that convey, sometimes metaphorically, stories that encapsulate different lessons, etc. Since the source for almost all of our knowledge and beliefs about reward and punishment, and the world to come, Tchiyat HaMetim, Mashiach, etc., is it within the realm of the Agadah, the Rambam feels it necessary to explain to us the proper manner of reading and interpreting Agadic literature. And that's one of the most important things in this work. And then he enumerates the 13 principles of faith. The addition of the work that I'm going to look at, that we're going to be using as the basis for our text, is a volume called the Hakdamot HaRambam LeMishnah. One volume that I mentioned that there are these different essays, these standalone essays in the commentary on the Mishnah, so they've been collected together into one volume. You can buy, usually it's in three volumes, you can buy the Rambam's entire commentary on the Mishnah, which is also usually printed in the back of the Gemara. If you have a set of Talmud, in the back of the Gemaras on each Masechta is also the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah for that Masechta, as well as these springboard essays. But it's usually printed in such a way that it makes it unrealistic to do serious reading there. So this is one volume, a modern translation. It's a translation into Hebrew of a contemporary translation into Hebrew by Rav Yitzchak Shilat from Male Adumim here in Israel. It was done in the last number of years. And you'll see it has... You'll see it was done in 1997. You'll see he has punctuation and punctuation and vowels, and there's also some useful notes. So I'm going to take just 2 more minutes. Let's at least start, and then we'll continue next week, really into the thick of it. But I think that this whole by way of introduction is necessary for us to move on. After quoting the Mishnah that we already looked at, here, the Hakdama LaPerek Chelek, the Rambam says, Ra'iti ledaber kan b'ikarim rabim be'emunot. I found it necessary. He says, you know, time out. I'm going to pause, and instead of going Mishnah by Mishnah, I'm going to write this longer a discourse on the matter of Ikarim Rabim Be'emuna, various principles of our faith. Ramei Ha'erech Ma'od, very exalted matters. Chapter 1. Da, you should know, ki Anshei HaTorah. Anshei HaTorah probably means, you know, us, Jewish people. People who are religious Jews. People who are involved in Torah. It doesn't necessarily mean scholars. It doesn't necessarily mean Talmidei Chachamim or rabbis or whatever. It's you and me. Ki anshei haTorah nechleku deotehem batova asher yizkela haAdam b'kiyum eile haMitzvot. There are various opinions as to what is the tova, what is the good, what is the profit, what is the value that we will acquire to ourselves, what's the reward that a person gets for fulfilling mitzvot. He says, look, people, good people, I'm not talking about the bad guys. I'm talking about the good guys, the people that get up and go to shul every morning and give tzedakah and say brachot and take care of their kids and help old ladies cross the street. But he says, people, there are different opinions amongst the masses about what the reward is and what's the motivation for doing mitzvot. The mitzvot asher tzivanu Hashem b'hen al yedei Moshe Rabbeinu. And alternatively, there are different opinions as to what the punishment is. What's the evil that befalls somebody that transgresses the mitzvot? Machloket Rabba Ma'od, a very great disagreement. Lefi chiluk haskalim, different categories based upon people's level of understanding. V'nishtabshu bazeh hadeot shibush rav. And many people, these good people, these otherwise nice, good, frum Jews, they've become confused. They've become confounded. Because they are not clear on what's the truth. Ad shekimat lo timtza b'shum panim adam sheitbarer lo inyan zeh. Until it's almost impossible to find somebody who's got it all clear. Meaning he's saying there are Jews, otherwise observant Jews, who do the mitzvot, but their understanding of why they do the mitzvot, and their understanding of why they avoid averot, or what the consequences of doing sins are, that's all messed up. Meaning it's not a halachic problem. It's not that there are people that don't know how to keep Shabbat. They know how to keep Shabbat. But they don't know what the motivation is. They don't know what the reward is. They don't know what the punishment is. They're all confused about these things. V'chein lo timtza bo dvarim muchlatim l'ish, ela b'irvuv rav. It's all mixed up. It's all mishkabibbled. And then he elaborates 5 groups. 5 categories of belief about our conception of reward and punishment. And he says that these he presents these groups not as straw men per se, but as examples of different categories of mistaken belief. He's telling you this is what people believe, but it's wrong. Next time we will get into this taxonomy, the taxonomy of mistaken beliefs about reward and punishment. And we might be surprised to discover that some of us fall into these categories. Boy, vavei. We're going to try to clear that up. So we'll start off with the discussion of schar va'onesh, reward and punishment. What's the incorrect beliefs, and then what, according to the Rambam, are the correct beliefs. When we study, just one final thought. When studying matters of emunot v'deyot, of belief, of philosophy, etc., it's important to keep an open mind. We're looking at what the Rambam said, for the reasons that I described, because the Rambam, again, stands head and shoulders. But there are other opinions, legitimate opinions, within our tradition that sometimes either differ or sometimes put a different spin or nuance on things, and to understand that when it comes to the realm of emunot v'deyot, there are certain viewpoints which are clearly incorrect. There are certain viewpoints which are incompatible with Torah and mitzvot. But there's room for, within the set of legitimate ideas, there's room for differences of opinion. Because unlike halakha in the conventional sense, in the garden variety sense, where we need a psak, we need to know what to do, and we need for everyone to be doing the same thing, at least within each community. It could be that Ashkenazim don't eat kitniot and Sephardim do eat kitniot, and we can live with diversity like that. It could be that some people follow this opinion and some people follow that opinion. And as long as you're playing by the rules, it's legitimate. But in principle, the overwhelming majority of halachic discussion comes down to one normative position. This is the way we do it and not that way. And there are important reasons for that. In the realm of emunot v'deyot, in the realm of philosophical positions and beliefs, there's room for more nuance. There's room to explore different points of view. Again, it's not a free-for-all. It doesn't mean that anything goes. There are opinions and beliefs which are clearly antithetical to Torah. But built into the system, we allow for different voices. So if the Rambam is talking about something that doesn't completely resonate with you, first of all, you have to work. You have to think. You have to struggle. You have to explore the ideas. You have to delve into them to make sure you fully understand them. Then you can start looking at other great chachamim, other scholars, other rishonim and achronim and rabbis and teachers who address the same topic, and you can start to flesh out a more eclectic worldview that accounts for other things, that accounts for other issues and developments, and etc. Our task during this series is to look at what the Rambam has to say. And again, the Rambam, you can't move without the Rambam. And you can't easily dismiss the Rambam. But he's not the only opinion on these matters. And there are other opinions on certain things, and there are differences of opinion, and Be'ezrat Hashem, maybe one day in the future, we'll look at some of those. But our task together during this series is to look at the Nesher HaGadol, the great eagle, the Rambam. Again, you have my email and my Google chat and my Skype. please be in touch. I will, from time to time, post things by email and or to our Shear homepage for you to look at and explore. And I will, on occasion, post questions for you to think about and ideally respond to in advance of each Shear. Again, please try to get a webcam and a microphone so that we can make this more of a dialogue and less of a monologue.